We are not safe. There we go. That's for sure. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And that's a good thing, because I don't think I'm going to be perfect anytime soon. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and this is the stuff we've covered already, and our personal adventures before and after, which are the stories in the back of the book, have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you're alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. And C, that God can and will. It's designed to sell you in the ABCs. I also believe that the 12-step job, which this has a lot to do with when you're 12-stepping someone, your job is to sell them on the same thing. Your job is to sell them on the unmanageability. Because if they're anything like I was, they may not understand what's going on. The process of an alcoholic death, because you can't see the truth from the false, sometimes you need somebody to bring in a little truth. You know what I mean? And sometimes you have to do a sales job on a 12-step call. And I think a lot of the preceding information is designed to sell us on its merits. It's designed to sell us that we're powerless. Designed to sell us that we have an unmanageable life, that we have a spiritual malady, that we can't stay away from alcohol and we can't stop drinking it once we start. All this is very important information. If you are not convinced on the vital issues, you ought to reread this book to this point or else throw it away. I love that. See that? Imagine all the big books flying out the window. Oh, yeah. That's a bunch of garbage. Give me another beer.
Let's go back to 60:2. 60:2. Has anybody ever heard of the expression, you know, it's in the ABCs? For years I've heard that, and I hate to admit it, but I was probably 10 years sober, but somebody said the ABCs. A, B, C. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, and I went, that's what they're talking about. It's in the ABCs. And here it is, right? Look at the next sentence in 60:3. Being convinced. Being convinced of what? Being convinced of the ABCs. So the question for you right now is, are you convinced of the ABCs? What are the ABCs? It's basically the first two steps. That you're alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. Are you convinced of step one? You believe that probably no human power could have relieved your alcoholism. Also part of step one, that you're powerless. You know, and C, that God could and would if you were soft. Step two. You know, you need to be convinced of that stuff up to this point. And then look with the next little squiggly lines again. It must be important. We are now at step three. And notice it doesn't say we've taken step three. We're only up to step three. Why? Because step three is which we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that and just what do we have to do? Well, I think they're going to tell us. Look here, more requirements. Ever heard, remember that question we asked last night? Are there requirements to take before step three? Well, here it is. The first requirement, well, if there's a first, that must mean there's a second, right? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Right? There's your first requirement. Let's jump ahead to, there's a great story of the actor. We're running short of time. We don't have time to talk about it. But anybody that's read the big book knows the story of the actor. You know, it's the guy who's on the stage. It's all of us at certain times in our life. We're trying to run the show, except we forgot to tell people what their role was and what their lines are. And when the whole play starts to fall in, we get really upset because our plan isn't working out. It's nobody else knows that we're the ones who are trying to run the show, you know. 62:1. Remember the question last night, does alcohol destroy more alcoholics than anything else? Let's see if we can find the answer. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we made decisions based on self, which later puts us in a position to be hurt. Here comes what I believe to be the greatest promise the big book holds. This next line. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Why is that so important? Because if the problem is of our own making, that means we can change it. Otherwise, that person who died 10 years ago that you're still mad at and resentful for has to come back from the dead for you to get better. you know. My father can stay the same jerk he's always been, you know. My brothers and sisters can stay the same. That boss can be the same idiot. The same guy can drive out in front of me. Nothing has to change except me and how I relate to those things if I follow the rest of this program. My problems are of my own making. They arise out of myself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Who makes that possible? God makes that possible. That's why step two is so important. If you don't have a higher power, you got nothing. You're dead in the water, right here. We can't help you in AA. And there often seems no way of entirely ridding ourselves of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we have reduced our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, well, here comes our second requirement. Remember he said the first requirement was back over there? Now he's going to give us a second requirement. We had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Those are the two requirements prior to taking step three. Well, what is step three? We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. What is the decision? You know? Is step three turning your will and your life over? No, it's just a decision. It's the old analogy. Three frogs sitting on a log, two decide to jump off. How many are still sitting on the log? Three. They only made a decision to jump off the log. But the decision puts into effect a commitment. What good is a decision unless you follow through with what your decision was? Step three puts in place a commitment to continue on with the rest of the program. All right? What is the decision? Here it is. Most people don't even know what the decision is. And here it is. Next, we decided, there it is, that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal and we are his agents. He is the father and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this is the concept was the keystone, there's our next construction reference, of the new and triumphant arch to which we pass to a new freedom. What did we just say there? We said, God is going to be a director. What does the director do for the actor? He tells them what to do. We're going to let God tell us what to do. What a concept. Somebody's going to tell an alcoholic what to do, and we're going to listen? All right? He is the principal, and we are his agents. What's a principal and an agent? Think of it in terms of an insurance company. State Farm is the insurance company. I am the agent. I get my power from State Farm to go out and represent State Farm and write policies. Right? My power comes from State Farm, not from me. I am just an agent. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to let God tell us what to do, and we are going to be his representative. The power comes from him. Right? He is the father, and we are his children. What does the father do for his children? He loves them unconditionally. He provides for them for whatever their needs are, clothing, shelter, all that stuff comes from the father. Right? What happens if a child gets out of line? The father corrects us, right? So it's an interesting relationship that we're going to have with this decision. It's going to put in all kinds of promises, which come on the next page. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed, and here's an if. Remember, I said ifs are conditions. We need to know what the condition is. Look at this promise. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him, capital H, and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. As we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Those are some great, great promises in this book. Now let's look at the warning. 63:3. Bill Wilson does it backwards. He has you take the third step prayer, but then he gives you the warning after you've taken the prayer. We're not going to do that to you. We're going to reverse it. Look at the warning. 63:3. We found it very desirable to take the spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional. So long as we express the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. So, if there's anybody interested in it, Chris is going to go ahead and lead us through the third step prayer. We're going to do it the way they did it in the old days. Back on the if you go back into the old text, on the old text, page 29, it says, get down on your knees and say to your maker as you understand him. So for anybody that cares to join us, you don't have to participate, but if you want to, if you've never taken the third step prayer with another person on your knees, there's something tremendously freeing about it. So we're going to go ahead and do that now.
Because we're going to be his child, we're going to be his agent, and we're going to be his actor. Short silence before the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may be a witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
Wow, pretty easy, huh? We just covered in about 4 hours we took to go through steps 1, 2, 3. This program does not take a long time. You know? Look at 63:4. What does it say? It says next. Does that mean next? Like in like right now? Next? We launched. That means action. We're going to launch out on a vigorous action. The first step, which is a personal house cleaning. Many of us which have never attempted, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. You notice what it says. We are going to face and be rid of. The purpose, we're about to talk about a fourth step, and the fourth step is not about facing and learning how to deal with your character defects. It is not learning how to face and so that you can control them. It is so that you can face what's really there and get rid of them. If you're looking to figure out how to deal with these dysfunctional things in you, you're in the wrong place. We can help you face them and get rid of them. And that's what the four-step inventory is about. All right? So even though it says next, like right now, it's time for a cigarette break, and I know the addicts are getting kind of jumpy in their seats. So let's come back at 45, and we'll jump right into the fourth step. Starting at where we left off on 64:1. Okay. John, you ready? Okay. It says, therefore, we started on our personal inventory, and this was step four. And they go through a description here on 64:1. The first thing they do is they make an analogy to a business inventory. And they talk about any business that doesn't take inventory is going to go broke. Basic business sense. Well, the same thing. Anybody that doesn't take an inventory and see what kind of problems they got, they have no idea what they're going to have to deal with. So that's the first part of this process. 64:2, it says, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. We're going to look at various manifestations of self. Specifically, we're going to look at three separate inventories. We're going to look at the fear inventory, the resentment inventory, then we're going to look at the fear inventory, and then we're going to look at the sex inventory, and we're going to put a little twist on it. All right, because it's a harm done to others inventory, but most alcoholics do their harms through sex, you know. But there's a catch-all phrase that we're going to show you that'll pick up any other harms that are in there. All right, look at this. Remember the question that I asked? I said, "What kills more alcoholics than anything else? Is it alcohol?" My sponsor asked me that question, one of my first sponsors, and I thought, finally, I'm going to get an answer right. And I said, "Alcohol." And he goes, "No, you dummy. Look on 64:3." Resentment is the number one offender. It, resentment, destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it, remember it, we got to know what it is. Resentment stems all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed the people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. Stop. Remember what I said, we're not going to go past an instruction? I'm going to show you guys the no-brainer, simple way to do four-step inventory, and it's going to come straight out of the big book. All right? Here's our first instruction. What is the instruction? We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. Now I'm going to jump onto a different mic here. Can you guys all see that? Let's swing a chair around here. That's kind of hard to see. The same thing is in your book, in your study guide on page 5. If you want a reference to that. Alright, looks like that. Only this is a filled-out copy. A little thing on the study guides. The study guides, I printed on 3-hole paper for a reason. So that you can put them in a notebook and take a staple out. So you can work with these things. That way, this page number 5, you can take out and xerox it if you want to do an inventory with it. This is the inventory sheet that I use for new guys. There's a short form and a long form. This is the short form. I do not take guys through the long form until they've done a couple inventories. And I try to do it the exact same way that Dr. Bob did it. Alright? The way Dr. Bob did it, it was all oral. Bill was the one who started to write and talk about doing a written inventory. With Dr. Bob, you'd sit down and he would talk to you about inventory process. And with this inventory, our first instruction is person, institution, or principle. You notice at the top of the top left-hand corner, it says person, institution, or principle. This is column 1. How many people in here have done a 4-step before?
Okay.
How many people in here have done 3-column inventory? How many people have you also done a 4th-column inventory? Okay. The big book only gives us 3 columns on the page. When we flip the page over to 65, the example, we got I'm resentful at, the cause and effect mine. Those are only 3 columns. The 4th column is written out in longhand, and it's a description a couple pages later. That's one of the reasons that a lot of people miss column number 4. A resentment inventory is a 4-column inventory, and I'll show you where those instructions come from. You know? Why is this inventory process so hard to understand? You need to go back and take a look at some of our history. If you go back into our history book, originally the big book was about, it depends who you listen to, but it was at least 400 pages longer than it is today, and the 400 pages were included in Chapter 5, How It Works. All 400, according to our history book. They were edited out. And pass it on page 204, it says Usel, which is Tom Usel, he was an editor, who edited the big book for us before it went to printing, cut out of the book by at least a third, some say half, from 800 to 400 pages, and sharpened it in the process. Later on in that chapter, it says we were broke. We couldn't pay our rent. We got thrown out of the place where our offices down there in Elizabeth, New Jersey. We moved up to Newark. When they did that, it says later on, we didn't have time to carry the boxes with us, so we threw all that stuff away. We lost the however number of pages, it was at least 400 pages, that we cut out of the big book, got thrown away. You know? Specifically, that's where it says the 400 pages of Chapter 5. So we know it was How It Works, was where the pages came from. What did it have to be? It had to be the description that Bill used to describe how to write an inventory. He used 53 pages to talk about step one. Something as complex as the 4-step, my opinion is, and it's only an opinion, not experience, but my opinion, I would have to guess that Bill wrote in depth how to write an inventory. And Usel said, you don't need that. Cut it out. We'll give them a bare-bones example. They can figure it out on their own. And that's why we have the 3 columns in the big book and the description in 1 paragraph later on 4. All right? If nothing else, it sounds good. You know, so if you want to believe it. So we have person, institution, or principle. That's the first thing. How do we write inventory? We write inventory vertically. Alright? I was taught you write inventory vertically and you don't go to the next column until you finish the 1st column. So the 1st column is person, institution, or principle. I give you some examples. Mom. 2nd example is dad. 3rd example, alcohol. 4th example, authority. 5th example, work. Just listen to them right down there. Mom and dad are people. Alcohol. Alcohol is a thing, right? You can write inventory on things. You can rank, it says person institution. The institution would be the drinking institution. You know, institutions are things like the IRS, the post office, wherever you work, you know, whoever your employer happens to be, that's an institution, right? It could be your rehab that you're resentful at. I don't care. Principles are perfect things. Authority, the principle of authority, the principle of inequality. The classic example, it showed up on my inventory about a year and a half, 2 years ago when I was doing one of my inventories. I had the principle of inequality showed up. Why? Because through several lawsuits in the airline industry, because it's predominantly male pilots, they started hiring minorities. Not because of their qualifications, just because of the fact that they're a minority. Well, on a dark and stormy night, I don't care who's sitting in that seat next to me, whether they're green, blue, male, female, doesn't matter to me, as long as they know what the hell they're doing. You know? And it really stuck in my craw that they were hiring people based on the color of their skin or what kind of chromosomes they had, not based on their experience. That was the principle of inequality, and it ended up on my inventory. Alright? So anything that gets you upset, fancied or real, has the power to actually kill. If it's in doubt, put it on your inventory. Which brings me to another point. I now have a relationship with a higher power. So my goal is to use the higher power. I don't have the power to write inventory of myself. That would be me trying to self-will my inventory. So the first thing I do is I sit down with pen and paper, get another to write inventory, and I say a prayer. You'll find an example of an inventory prayer, pre-inventory prayer in the book. It's sort of like a set-aside prayer. I ask God to take me to that space, to remove my fear, the things that are going to block me off from seeing the truth that my ego doesn't want the sunlight of the spirit to see. Says, what are we going to do? We're going to face it and be rid of it. My ego does not want me to take a look at this stuff. If I take a look at it and it's gone, my ego has no longer a tool to work with me. You know? But that's my goal. So I ask God to take me into a place to write inventory. When I'm done writing inventory, whether I finish one column or all four columns, whether I do all my inventory in one sitting or not, when I'm done writing inventory for the time being, and you'll know when that is, I put the pencil down and I ask God to take me out of that space. Why? Because it's been my experience that I've written inventory and asked God to take me into that place, and I'm so tired with my natural reaction. Man, I'm emotionally worn out. Let's go to a meeting. I go to the meeting, and what comes out? I raise my hand, and I share stuff in an open AA meeting that belongs in a system, not in an open AA meeting. All right? So ask God to take you into space to write inventory, and when you're done, ask Him to take you out of that space. And He will keep you safe and protected. That's what we talked about in the third step, right? He's going to provide what we need as long as we keep close to Him. All right? So I read column one, person is your principle. What's our next instruction? Once I got column one written down, our next instruction says, we ask ourselves why we're angry. Period. Stop. That is column two. You'll notice at the top. Why are you angry? These are my comments now. Be very specific and it must be the truth. Why? Alcoholics love to hide under an umbrella of generality. The classic example, my mother was never there for me. Well, what the hell does that mean? You know? A friend of mine, Mark Houston, says, I smell more. You know, let's dig into it. I smell more. A friend of mine that I was working with one time, he comes to me after an AA meeting, says, hey, can we talk? He goes, sit in his truck, and he's talking to me about his inventory. And he's got on his inventory, and I've secured his permission to use this example. He said, Dad was never there for me. And I said, come on, I smell more. Let's dig into it. About 5 minutes later, you know what column two read? Column one was Dad. Column two was homosexual. That's what he meant by my dad was never there for me. That's a big difference in never being there for me than from being my dad's a homosexual. And that's really what he was pissed off about. Why is it important to be specific and be the truth? Because column three is based off of column two. If you put a lie, even a little lie, in column two, that makes column three a lie, and column four is based off of column three, the rest of it is wasted. Everything is based off a lie. Let's get down to the causes and conditions. Let's get down to the truth. Alcoholics don't want to do that. Let's be very specific. My dad, he beat me. I say, when? All the time? Every moment of the day, your dad beat you? Well, no. He beat me once. I'm like, okay. Then write down when my dad beat me, or when my dad beat me after I came home late, or whatever it was. Let's be specific to the point. Let's not make it so general that nobody knows what it is. here's my experience. When I have a new guy, he's got lots of resentments. He is clogged up. I got to clean it out. Remember where God's going to reside? Deep down within us, right? I make the analogy of it's a drain. It's like a sink. And you got a big hairball. You got this big hairball of resentment. We got to reach in there and get rid of the hairball, right? But then there's a big the trap is clogged with grief. We got this grief called fear. So once we get the anger, because he's blinded by anger, we take the resentment, we do that inventory, get that out of the way. Then we get the fears. We take the fears, we do a fear inventory, get rid of the fears, and what's left to block us from God? That open channel to God is the guilt of the harms we've done to others. Specifically, the guilt we did in the sexual arena. It's pretty much most alcoholics, that's where we do most of our really bad harms, where we really hurt people, is in the sexual arena. Once I clean up these three inventories, I now have an open channel to my inside. I'm no longer afraid. I have an open channel to God, and it's a place for God to reside inside me. As Ozzy said, you know, with that analogy he gave from the Bible about the spirit, you clean the house out, now there's a place for God to dwell, you know, inside of you. There's a place inside you to be filled up. People we hear described in A meetings as the God hole, you know, and we try to fill it with all kinds of things, with overeating and gambling and drinking, and it doesn't work for us. That's what we're talking about. Let's clear the channel and have God reside inside of ourselves, because that's our power. That's where the power comes to live our lives. Right? So, here's what I do. I give this to a new guy. He's got dozens of resentments, and I say, write them down. What are you mad at? He writes down a whole list of things in column one. Right? He writes down whatever the truth is in column two, and I happen through the truth. Then I take the paperwork. That's he's done writing. And then I start off with a fifth resentment, and I say, hey, you're mad at your mom because she left you at the store. You know, he was a little kid, 5 years old, his mom took off and forgot that he was inside the store still. That happened. You know, there's a woman here who broke the story with me this weekend. She took a look at the sheet, she came up to me and she said, that was 30 years ago and my son is still holding it over my head. I left, I forgot him at the store. You know, she's still broken up about it 30 years ago. You know, I asked him, I said, hey, when your mom did this, did it hurt, threaten, or interfere with these seven areas? Where do they come from? Let's look in the book. In most cases, we're in 64.3 at the last two sentences. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, needs number one, our pocketbook, number two, our ambition, number three, our personal relations, number four, flip the page, including sex, were hurt or threatened. Notice those two words, hurt or threatened. That's where I get those two words from. So when we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, which that's a repeat, our security, there's a new one, number five, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, now we've specifically broken out sex relations, there's number six, which had been interfered with. We were usually as definite as this example. Wait a minute, that's only six. There's seven areas that can be affected. Look in the right column all the way down under my wife, column number three. What does it say? Pride. So pride, I had a terrible time with pride. I didn't understand what pride was. But if you talked about my ego, I knew what it was. So on the chart, I put pride in a little parenthesis as ego. Ego is not part of the big book, but it makes it easier for me to write inventory. I understand it when I talk about my ego. Was my ego affected? Yeah, I know what that means. With my pride, I still have, to this day, I have a hard time understanding pride. That's just a personal technique. That's why that's written that way. So these are the seven areas of self that can be hurt, threatened, or interfered with. So I'll say to the guy, okay, your mom left you at the store. Did that hurt or threaten with your self-esteem? I give him a definition for self-esteem. It's how I see or feel about myself. That's the definition. And I just say it just like that. And he'll go, oh yeah, it affected how I felt about myself. I put a little check in the box. Why am I putting a check in the box? Because when I look down the checks, when I get to column four, I know that if the box is checked off, I need to answer those four questions from column four. All right? This will all make more sense once we show you how it works all together and get all the instructions down. So I just go through and I start checking off the list. It's not uncommon for me to sit down with a newcomer and go through 75, 80, 90 resentments in an hour. Why am I going through it fast? A, because I got to get this guy some freedom. He's carrying around the weight of all this guilt and remorse and this anger, and it's killing. This isn't the last inventory. If the guy's going to work with me, this is the beginning of a lifetime process. 6 months after we do a fourth step and a fifth step, we make a date and we put it on the calendar, and that's when he starts writing inventory again. It goes on the calendar, you know, and we get the guy into a cycle of writing inventory regularly because it's his life. you know. That's my experience. You know, take it for what it's worth. Alright? So, look at 55:3. It says, we went back through our lives. You think Bill Rick meant this next statement? Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we get to the long forms, I've had people balk at writing the long forms. Long form is just the exact same four columns, except if, instead of column three, we don't just put a check mark. We actually write out how it was hurt, threatened, or interfered. You just write it out longhand. It affected me this way, and you write it out. Boom, 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 boom. It's the committee that would talk to us in our head that's really arrogant and pompous. Nobody should do that stuff to me. I'm better than that. That's the kind of stuff that goes in column three when you're doing the long form. A newcomer is monkish. He can't handle that. So I don't make him do it. I just check it off so I know at which questions I have to ask him. This is the answer to us, is column four. This is where we see our part in the resentment. Where does column four come from? Flip two pages over to 67:2. It says, referring to our list again, which is this list, column 1, 2, and 3, putting out of the mind our mind the wrongs others have done. All right, we don't care what's in column 2. That's the wrong they did. We don't care about that anymore. All right, where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Notice it doesn't say had we been. It says where had we been. Bill Wilson knew enough that if you're holding on to resentment that's 5, 10, 15 years old, you've got to be getting something out of it, a sick, misshapen pleasure out of it, right? As it says in the 12 and 12. Well, here's where it comes from. You must have been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Where were you to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's fault. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. That's the description for column four. So I take my guy through. I know that the fact that his mother forgot him at the store affected his self-esteem. And I say, what's selfish about that? He goes, there's nothing selfish. Oh, it's all right for me to be a little kid and my mother forgot me, so I don't want my mother to forget me at the store. And I said, oh, you don't want, in your scheme of life, when you're playing God, you don't want your mother to leave you at the store. That is a selfish thing. I'm not judging it right or wrong. That is a fact. It is a selfish thing to want. Oh, okay, so I write it in column form. Not wanting to have my mother leave me at the store. Where is he being dishonest? He's lying to himself. Life isn't like that. You don't get what you want. His mother made a mistake and left him at the store. That's life. He's lying to himself to think that life is going to be on his terms. It's not. He's also lying to God. Right? He got left at the store. God has a plan. We may not know what it is, but God has a plan. You know? And he's trying to play God, which is an assault and an affront to God. To me, that's being dishonest to God. Who else is he lying to? He's lying to his mother. He's being dishonest with his mother because he's expecting her to do things that she wasn't capable of. She's a human being. She made a mistake. In his mind, it's not okay for his mother to make a mistake when it affects him. That has colored his relationship with his mother. So there's almost always three areas of dishonesty. We always lie to ourselves because we believe our own line is fact. Try it again. There we go. I've never seen it where we're not dishonest to ourselves. If we're able to hold on to resentment for any length of time, we're lying to ourselves. All right? The reason we're lying to ourselves and we're upset is because we're not getting our way, which tells me that we're trying to play God, so we must be lying to God in some form or another. And then usually we're lying to the other person because our behavior towards that person is colored by this anger that we're holding inside. We're not treating them the way we should. We're not treating them like a fellow child of God. We're treating them other than what they really are. They're human, they're fallible, they make mistakes, and we're holding it over their heads. Does that make sense? Self-seeking. That's looking for something that you come out with the benefit. It may be like, for example, like if I want a new house for my family, supposedly, who else benefits? Somehow, because the new house comes, yeah, it's great for my wife and my kids, I also get a benefit out of it. My motivation for getting a new house, alcoholics hide a bad motive under a good. I would say, oh yeah, we're outgrowing this house, we need a bigger house. I could care less because we're outgrowing a house. I want a new house. But I'll use that to justify it. Invariably, if you look at resentment, you'll find a way that you're being self-seeking. You're getting some benefit. If life were to work out the way your plan was, you would have gotten some benefit out of it, and that is the self-seeking part. And really, what are we afraid of? What is this kid, and by the way, this is just a hypothetical made-up example. What is this kid afraid of? What is his fear? He's afraid that he's not important to his mother. How could she forget him at the store if he's that important? He's afraid of being unloved. He's afraid of being abandoned. He was abandoned. It became a reality. One of his greatest fears became a reality. So you just write out the fears. Now we got the resentment inventory. We got the four columns. Alright? Let's go back. We missed a couple instructions. On 55:3, we talked about that. It says, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. When we finished, we considered it carefully. There's another it. What are we talking about? Columns 1, 2, 3. How are we going to consider it? Let's flip the page. It's apparent to us that in this world, its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and when we were sore ourselves, but the more we fought, we tried to have our own way. The worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, remember the problems of our own makeup? We permit the resentment, right? Do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave, we found it is fatal. That's why alcoholics die more from anger than from anything else. Because resentments are fatal to us. We use it as the excuse to go out and drink. You know? Oh, you hurt my feelings, I'll show you. You know? It's a classic battle charge for an alcoholic. I'll show them and they'll be sorry. You know? I'll teach them a lesson. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. It may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to our future. The list, what list? This list holds the key to your future. You think that's important? You think four-step inventory writing is important to your sobriety? Damn right. How many people have ever been to an AA meeting where that was a topic? How the four-step is the key to your future. I just held one of those meetings at my home group, with the stodgy old-timers, and let me tell you, you start carrying some spiritual truth to AA meetings and challenging people and showing them a mirror that they don't want to look into, you become very unpopular very quickly. Right? We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that our resentments had to be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms, symptoms are in column 2, that's their symptoms of their spiritual sickness, and the way they disturbed us, that's column 3, how it affected us, right? They, like ourselves, don't just point the finger and say they're sick, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Look at these next three words. We ask God. I was taught that any time this book says, we ask God anything, that's a form of prayer. So I took this paragraph and turned it into the form of a prayer. And you'll find those in the guide. You know, there's a pre-inventory prayer on page 6, and at the bottom of page 6 is a resentment prayer. And you'll notice 76:0 at the bottom there is the reference of where that, these are just things that I did, you know. If it says we ask God, I try to take that paragraph or whatever that concept is out of the book and turn it into the form of a prayer. Alright? We ask God to help show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry, thy will be done. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chances of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us. Notice that God's going to show you how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Alright? You'll notice in page 6 in your guide, I gave you 18 tools for resentment. It's all the instructions we've just got done talking about. All right? And that's it right there. If you flip the page over to page 7 in your guide, this is called the long form. It's the exact same stuff. All right? Column 1, top of the page there, it says person, institution, or principle. You just list them down. You know where this came from? Because I'm anal. I got tired of writing out inventory, so I put it on the computer. And this just happens to be a blanked out copy of an inventory I did a couple years ago. There's no rhyme or reason for why there's, you know, H or F in the first block. That happened to be, every one of my inventories has the exact same person as number one, and it's been my father. And at that time, I happened to have, you know, what, 7 resentments or however many that letters, those letters are. And that's my dad, you know, and that's the way I wrote it. Column 2, you notice at the top it says the cause of the event, why I'm angry. You know, listen, why in the long form is it on a separate piece of paper? Because of the instruction in column 4. It says we don't care why the other person harmed us. By the time you get to column 4, you can take this piece of paper because it's separate and lay it aside. You don't have to look at the harm they did to you. Now you get the chance to really look at the harm you caused yourself. You get to look at where were you selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. All right? And let me emphasize it again. I do not give these forms to people that have not been through inventory before. So if you haven't been through this kind of inventory, go through with somebody that has with a short form. Do that a couple times. I've seen more people come with like 300 resentments and they try to do the long form and they're trying to write out 300 column 3s and 300 column 4s and they get bogged down in the process and they become spiritually unstable. You know? Flip the page in the guide to page 8. This is column 3. It's just an elaborate column 3. Instead of the checkoff boxes, I gave you a space to write out. In the slot, you just fill in. Person, institution, or principal, you write in whoever you're mad at. I'm mad at mom. Which resentment is it? It's resentment A. If I put down forgot me at the store, a lot of times people have a tendency to grab a hold of that when they get into column 3 and column 4. That's why column 1 and 2 are able to be separated. That's why I'm on a separate piece of paper. Does that make sense? Yes? I hope so. The definitions on the left-hand column. These are the 7 areas of self and a definition for each one of those 7 areas that can be affected. You'll notice up in the top block, I wrote, stay away from I think and I feel. My own personal experience. If I'm writing, I feel angry, who can challenge that? It's a feeling. Feelings aren't facts, they're just feelings, and my feelings are my feelings. As a person hearing the fifth step, you've basically tied my hands, because I can't challenge the way you feel. What is causing you to feel that way? Get down to the point of what's the underlying root. Let's go to the next layer deeper in the onion. At the bottom of the page, I give you examples of what goes in there. Column 3 is what we're going to do in a minute. We're going to go through the theater of the lie. It's the committee that we hear talked about in AA. It's that really arrogant, the voices that go on, you know, that nobody should treat me that way. You know, and that's where the real anger boils up in it. How dare they? Now, we'd never say that out loud because then we'd look bad and we're afraid of looking bad. But in our mind, that committee is going all the time, you know, and we jump from committee member to committee member to committee member. You know, one minute we're angry, the next minute we're, oh, poor me, I can't believe I got hurt, you know, they did that to me, you know. All that stuff goes on between our ears. That's the kind of venom that has to come out in column 3. And you'll notice the examples at the bottom. Under self-esteem, I deserve better, I want better, I should have, no one should be able to do this stuff to me. Under pocketbook, I need money, I deserve a good job. And notice pocketbook, it doesn't say just money. It's anything to do with your financial system. You know, it affects your pocketbook. It could be your inheritance. A lot of times I see that. Something, they'll be angry at something over here, but what it really comes down to is if that person stays angry because of whatever this event was over here, they're afraid they're not going to get inheritance over here. That's affecting their pocketbook, and they don't want to take a look at it. Right? Have you ever seen one of those games at the carnival where the little hamsters pop up or whatever they are, groundhogs? You whack them with a padded hammer and another one pops over here? You'll find a lot of that going on in column 3. You'll be angry over here. You'll say, I'm angry at my father over here because I'm mad at this thing over here. And by the time you get to column 4, you realize, wait a minute, well, I'm really angry. It's way over here. You know, it was just the way your ego twisted it so it could hide a bad motive underneath the good. Right? And then column 4 is, I give you an example of column 4 filled out on page 10. There's a blank one in case you ever come to write inventory. We're using these forms on page 11. And once again, they're Xeroxable, so that you can Xerox these. Alright? That's the down and dirty of basically four-column inventory for resentment. Alright? Anybody have any questions at this point? I know I threw it at you kind of fast because we're a little bit behind on the time, but the basic pieces is column one, person, institution, or principle. Column two, why are you pissed off? Why are you angry? What did this person do? Be very specific, and it has to be the truth. Column three is the seven areas of self that can be affected. Remember back on the instruction, back on page 64, it says, being convinced that self manifested in various ways, this is the areas of self, the seven areas. You know, self-esteem, pocketbook, personal relations, sex relations, pride, you know, security. Those are the areas that can be affected. That's what we're going to look at in column three. Column four is where we're going to take a look at our part of the street. Now, questions come up, particularly, I used to do, before I got married, I did a lot of work with women. And a lot of times you come up with, and now I get the same thing with men, actually. Sexual abuse. They say, when I was 8 years old, I was sexually abused. Alright? And they're saying, how can any of that be my fault? They did it to me. And I say, here's my straightforward answer, and it's the truth, I shoot from the hip. It's not your fault. It absolutely 100% is not your fault. It's an atrocity. It's terrible that it ever occurred. When did it happen? Well, back when I was 8 years old. Well, how old are you now? I'm 40. And they go, wait a minute, that's 32 years ago. And you're still pissed off about this thing? Like, yeah. That's what you own. It was a terrible thing that occurred. It happened way back in the past. But the fact is, you're still holding on to it. It may be 99.9% the other person's fault that this thing occurred, and you may own the 0.1%, but you own 100% of that 0.1%. The fact that if you're still holding on to this thing 32 years later, who's it killing? Not the person that did the sexual abuse. It's killing. They may be dead and buried, and you're still dying inside. Now, who's getting hurt? You are. We're here to take a look at our side of the street. So when it gets down to column four, that's where we really have to work at separating and finding the truth. And as a person hearing the fifth step and working with this kind of stuff, you better ask God to give you direction and speak through you. A lot of times the stuff that comes out of my mouth when I'm hearing this stuff, I don't know where it comes from. And people look at me and they go, wow, you really understand. And I'm like, it just came. I asked God to give me the words, and the words came to help you. You know, if people bring me things that I don't have experience with, I send them to places where they can get the help. Guy came to me terribly messed up emotionally about Vietnam. I'm a veteran, but I wasn't in Vietnam. Very unusual things happened in Vietnam. I know several people to send them to who were Vietnam vets. Go talk to this guy. He can help you. I can't. How do I know those people? Because I do this work. That's one of the other reasons we need to be working the program of AA. We need to be out there carrying the message, and then you get resources like this. You know? It's really important stuff. This is kind of stepping out of the line when I'm talking about fifth step, since I mentioned it already. If you are given the blessing, the grace of God to hear somebody's fifth step, please treat it as if you have their life in your hand, because you do. I've seen terrible, terrible damage done to people, and stuff that was shared in confidence gets spread around. As the person going to do a fifth step, you have a responsibility. Don't blame it on the other person. You get to choose who to do your fifth step with. I think it's on. Check to make sure it's on.
Hello.
Who are you?
I'm Peter. My home group is the Rockmont Street Group in Freehold, New Jersey. On page 67, second paragraph, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes.
Yes.
In the fourth column, you ask, where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened?
Yes.
And then it goes on to say, though a situation not have been entirely our fault, we try to disregard the other person involved entirely. Then it asks us another question.
Sure.
Because where are we to blame?
That's right.
Why don't we have that on that?
Because my experience again, to take a look at my part of where I'm being selfish, I've been dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, that is the blame that I've been carrying that I don't want to take a look at. It's sort of a redundant question. At least that's my experience. I know other people that write out another question. Where was I to blame? And I find guys doing that. Usually, the ego sneaks in at that point, and it becomes a justification line. They'll say, I'm responsible here for this, I'm responsible for this, I'm responsible for this, I'm responsible for this, and where was I to blame? And they usually make an excuse. You know? I found this is where you are to blame. It's kind of a question, basically a broad question about these four things. So this is the way I was taught to do it. You know, I've seen other people's inventories and they've got an extra question there. They got five questions in column four, where was I to blame? He's got the microphone behind him. These are the real juicy amends. Juicy resentment. When I see a guy and he's been affected in all seven areas, I'm going to spend some time on this one. Because I know that this goes to his core. It's affected every area of his life. And the other thing that's neat about putting them in this way, you get to see, if you see the same parallel, resentment after resentment, a lot of times, column one and column two will be completely different things, yet you'll see the exact same columns checked off in how it's affected you. And really, it's the same resentment, we just put a different head on it. You know, I'm mad at you for whatever you did, and then I put that same kind of blame, and I'm mad at you for the exact same atrocity, and it shows up on my column as separate resentments, and really it's the same resentment. I've just done it with one person, and another person, another person, another person. It's on there. You know, I could do it just verbally and say, did it affect your self-esteem? And if you said, yeah, then I could sit there and say, start talking about the column four questions. I find it easier if you do all of the columns one at a time. Do all of column one, do all of column two, do all of column three, and then do all of column four. If you jump across, I find guys, it takes longer. It's like pulling teeth. They're like, yeah, but you start to justify, and then you try to take them right to column four for each resentment, and they get bogged down. If you go through all of column three, then they're feeling right and pumped up and justified, and yeah, they did this to me. And then you start talking about column four, where are you to blame? And you start taking them through those questions, resentment after resentment after resentment, and they start realizing, wow, it's all my problem. I've been holding it all me, and you don't give the ego a chance to jump back in there and take a look at column three again by keeping it separate that way. Does that make sense? Cool. It's 3:20. Any other questions before we break? Okay. 3:27. Why don't we come back at, I'll give you an extra 3 minutes, at 3:40, and we'll jump right into the theater of the lie. And what we're going to do, be prepared for some fun. First thing we're going to do is we're going to take one of my resentments. You know, 18 years sober, he still gets angry. We're going to put it up there, and we're going to go through the columns, and I'm going to show you how this resentment affected me. We're going to take only columns 1, 2, and 3. You guys are going to help me like you're doing a fifth step, and you're going to pull my resentment apart and show me my part in it, and we're going to make it come alive. We're going to, somebody in a relationship, you know, they're great if it's a boyfriend or a husband. It doesn't have to be. It can be some close personal relationship, and then we'll get a guy up here, and we'll roast them both. And we'll have a lot of fun. We'll do a lot of laughing. So come on back at 3:40, and we'll jump into it.